House Civil Law Committee will come to order. First order of business are the minutes from March 10th. Representative Rosenthal, having reviewed the minutes thoroughly, approves them and moves them. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. House File 2668, Representative Hillstrom, are you prepared to proceed? And if the testifiers in favor would join you. It's my understanding that you have a delete all amendment. Is this not this bill? Okay. Next one. Representative Hillstrom, please proceed. Representative Hillstrom moves that House File 2668 be re-referred to the General Register. Go ahead, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, this is the court's policy bill brought to me by the judiciary. And so I'm just going to let them tell you what it is. I believe it's fairly non-controversial.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Pete Cahill. I'm the Chief Judge in the 4th District, which is Hennepin County. And also what is relevant for this bill is I'm also Chair of the E-Court Minnesota Steering Committee. We have a number of primarily technical details that we are proposing, which fall into three categories. The first being to improve the process for our litigants. The first in Section 7 would require additional information to be submitted to a judge in a structured settlement case. Structured settlement is where someone receives a settlement instead of a lump sum, they receive it in a structured payment where they receive payments over time. They do have the right, if they wish, to try and sell that structured settlement for a lump sum, usually to a private company. But a judge has to approve that to make sure that everything is appropriate and that a sale of the structured settlement would be appropriate. What we are asking for is that additional information be provided to the judge who is evaluating that request to sell part of the structured settlement, specifically any prior attempts to sell, any prior sales of parts of the structured settlement, and how much was actually sold off, so that a judge is not in the dark as far as prior transactions that occurred. For example, somebody who may have had a structured settlement and sold a great part of it for only pennies on the dollar, and now is coming to sell the rest. The judge needs to know that they sold part of their structured settlement already. And so this is more to provide more information to the judge who is evaluating those requests. Our second provision is to provide a request that a hearing in response to a harassment restraining order must be made within 20 days after the petition is served. Current law is that the request for a hearing must be made 45 days after the petition is filed. The problem with that is very often the petition is not served until later. So if the petition is served on the 43rd day, that only gives the respondent 2 days to request a hearing. This would change that so that if the person was served on the 43rd day, they would have 20 additional days then to request a hearing. And so the operative date would not be the date of filing, but the date the person was actually served to make that demand. The third provision would provide permit application of fine payments to restitution. Well, actually, that restitution would be paid before fine payments. In State versus Knutson, the Minnesota Court of Appeals interpreted current statutes as providing that when the court orders both restitution and a fine, that the presumption is that the fine will be paid first and then restitution to the victim. Whereas the practice of most judges is to order restitution to the victim first, and once the victim is whole, to pay the fines. This provision would bring the statute in line with current practice, which is to pay the restitution to the victim first and then the fine. The second group of provisions that we are proposing further our eCourt Minnesota initiative. And the first is to eliminate the requirement that the court seal be a raised seal. That is an embossed seal. That works in the paper world, but obviously not in the electronic world. You can't emboss an electronic document. We would, however, still have an electronic seal put in place of the raised seal. In a similar vein, the second provision would be to remove the requirement for a notary on pleadings and affidavits filed with the court. This is strictly documents that are filed with the court. This does not affect real estate or other documents that require a notary. In its place, we are proposing language that any time a notary had been required before there would be a statement right above a signature line saying, I declare under penalty of perjury that everything I've said in this entire document is true. There's also a change as one of the sections to change the perjury statute to, in fact, make it perjury if you sign that falsely, to bring the two in line. We have checked with other states that have essentially changed their notary laws in this manner, and they have found no instances of fraud. It's not really something that lends itself. It's not like when somebody steals your ID to open a credit card in your name. Very few people want to steal your name to pay $300 to file an action in your name. There's really no benefit to it. And because of that, states such as Kansas, California, Texas have not seen any problems with fraud when they change from a notary system to an under penalty of perjury signature line. The final one under our eCourt Minnesota initiative is to permit e-service for certain probate cases. Currently, the probate code requires United States mail for certain documents to be exchanged when we have an e-service program, which is much more efficient, and so this would permit e-service for certain probate cases. It would also mandate it if the Supreme Court by order mandated it in a certain probate case. And finally, our last area that we are proposing is to create some efficiencies, is to provide the petitioners and errors and omissions petitions would be served or shall also serve the petition on all candidates for the office in which the error or omission is alleged. The best way to explain this is with an example. If somebody files a petition against the county auditor saying that candidate A should not be on the ballot, there is no requirement in the statute that candidate A actually be served with that petition. The statute does provide that anybody that the court orders to be served shall be served. Well, the first thing the Supreme Court does is they order that candidate A be served. This would just place that in the statute so we wouldn't have that delay of the petition being filed, the Supreme Court gets it, they then order it to be served on candidate A. It would just require from the outset that all candidates that are affected by that petition would be served. It would remove any delay, and just makes a whole lot of common sense that the candidates who are affected by such a petition be notified that it's been filed. And with that, I stand for questions.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Seeing none, then thank you very much for your testimony, Judge Cahill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other testifiers, Representative Hillstrom? Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Kevin Rich. My last name is spelled R-I-A-C-H. I'm an attorney at Frederickson and Byron. I'm here to just speak briefly on the structured settlement portion of the bill. First, I want to thank Representative Hillstrom and the Chief Judge Cahill for inviting me here to speak and commend them for the work they've done on this topic. I'm just here to let you know that the issue of judges receiving additional information when a structured settlement transfer petition is provided to them is not something that's theoretical and abstract. There's actually instances in which judges are making decisions about structured settlement transfers in which a large portion of a person's structured settlement or annuity stream that they've gotten as a result, say, of a personal injury settlement has already been transferred, and the court has really, under the current law, no way of knowing that's the case. And it's obviously a fact that's important to a judge's decision about whether or not they should go ahead with the transfer and approve of the transfer. I worked on a case several years ago. There was a woman who was asking to have her structured settlement transferred, and she had had a large portion of that settlement transferred in a previous action. The judge would have had no way of knowing that that had taken place, and it was important to his decision because she was asking to essentially have the remaining half or more than a third of her structured settlement transferred for literally pennies on the dollar. And the judge became suspicious during the brief hearing on the transfer that maybe there had been a previous transfer. He started asking some questions. Because of the adversarial nature of our system, the judge isn't allowed to just step out of the courtroom and start investigating, so he appointed a guardian to look into the matter. And I worked, represented that guardian, and together we discovered that there had been a significant transfer that had already taken place that hadn't been disclosed. And when the judge found out about it, that was an important part of his consideration in denying the ultimate petition. So this is an important issue. It's not something that's abstract or theoretical. There really is a need out there to change the bill to make sure the judges get the information that they need.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Rich. Any questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, then thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom, any closing comments?
I just encourage members to vote yes.
Thank you. Then Representative Hillstrom has moved to re-refer House File 2668 to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Next bill up, House File 2090, Representative Portman. Representative Portman moves that House File 2090 go to the General Register. And Representative Portman, you have an A14 delete all amendment. Members, the A14 amendment came in yesterday afternoon after the 24-hour deadline. But I asked individuals about what it does. In my estimation, it doesn't significantly affect it and is a good compromise. Representative Scott, did you have any comments about the delete all amendment?
Mr. Chair, thank you for asking. No, I think it's fine, and I would urge, I'm fine with going ahead and voting on it and waiving the 24-hour rule.
Okay, then all in favor of the A14 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author so desires, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Two-year bill as amended, Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2090 is a bill that is similar to a bill I've been carrying for a while for the American Council of Engineering Companies. And this committee passed a very similar bill last year, but it didn't move on the Senate side. There were some concerns by the Associated General Contractors. And the bill, the delete all amendment today, is the product of a compromise between AGC and ACEC. Really what the problem was that got me to start carrying this bill a few years ago is there's a requirement for indemnity agreements and some construction contracts that are really impossible for people to comply with. And the design professionals cannot obtain the insurance protection that they're supposed to agree to in the contract. And the bill with the delete all attached does is deal with that impossible indemnity clause situation that has existed for a while. I have three witnesses today to describe the problem. Dan Larson is a professional or a licensed professional engineer, Kimberly South, and Mark Bloomquist from Mir Gear. Mark is going to do the walkthrough, but we'll just start with Dan to describe the problem.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dan Larson. I'm with American Engineering Testing. I'm also a licensed professional engineer. My firm, American Engineering Testing, is a member firm of ACEC of Minnesota. I'm here today to speak in favor of the bill. This bill seeks to prevent provisions in design professional services contracts, specifically requiring design professionals to defend and indemnify others for their own negligence. We've been seeing more and more of these types of contracts, and we're being asked to sign them. And quite honestly, the problem that we deal with is that we cannot obtain professional liability insurance, which is our primary insurance for our services, that will cover another party's negligence. It simply doesn't exist in the marketplace. My firm has walked away from several of these contracts, including long-term clients that have changed their contract provisions in the most recent years. These are insurable, and as Representative Portman said, they are impossible provisions for us to sign. Some firms are signing these agreements. Maybe it's out of necessity. Maybe they need the work. Regardless, they're kind of rolling the dice. They're putting their firm at risk, and potentially they're putting the public at risk, because what might be happening is a lesser qualified firm is willing to sign the agreement, whereas some other firms, maybe more qualified, have refused. And finally, signing these contracts with these provisions kind of gives our client or the owner a false sense of security. They think they're protected, and in fact, they're not. There's no insurance if we sign these agreements indemnifying them for their negligence. Design professional firms are assets. We don't have a lot of hard assets, so ultimately, in the end, the protection lies in the insurance, and we simply can't get it. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Members, we're going to wait to take questions until all testifiers have proceeded. Ms. South, please introduce yourself to the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kimberly South, and I'm a licensed insurance agent and vice president at Dennis J. Lindard & Associates. Dennis J. Lindard & Associates is an independent insurance agency specializing in commercial insurance for architects, engineers, and other design professionals. I'm here today to confirm that architects and engineers can't buy insurance to ensure the indemnity provisions or the indemnity requirements in the contracts described by Mr. Larson. Our agency has over 200 clients that purchase architects and engineers professional liability coverage through our agency. We believe this represents a larger market share than any other insurance agency in the state. Professional liability insurance is a relatively small segment of the insurance industry. There are about 45 insurance companies that write architects and engineers professional liability coverage, and our agency has access to buy coverage from approximately 40 of those companies. An architects and engineers professional liability policy pays for damages or injuries caused directly by the negligent acts, errors, or omissions of the architect or engineer and their subconsultants for whom the architect or engineer is legally liable. I want to clearly state that professional liability policies won't pay for damages or injuries that are caused by the negligence or mistakes of another company that the architect or engineer isn't legally liable for, such as the contractor or project owner. None of the 40-plus insurance companies I previously mentioned will pay damages that are due to the negligence of an entity that the architect or engineer isn't legally liable for. None of these insurance companies are willing to modify the policy to provide coverage. I've been in the insurance industry over 38 years, and in this area of expertise, nearly 25, and the coverage is simply not available. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. South. Mr. Bloomquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Portman. My name is Mark Bloomquist. I'm a lawyer in private practice at the Meir & Gear law firm, and I provide volunteer help to the American Council of Engineering Companies. And as Representative Portman said, this bill's we've been working on this bill for a while, and the bill did make it through this through the House or this committee last year, but it did get bogged down in the Senate because there were some differences. There was some language in this bill that was having some unexpected effects on the Associated General Contractors. Since that time, over the off session and during this session, we've worked to work with the AGC, Associated General Contractors, to make sure that this bill doesn't have any unintended or negative effects on their members or anybody else in the industry for that matter. So we feel we do have consensus in the construction industry to carry this bill. As the other witnesses have said and Representative Portman said, that the key problem that we're addressing is the fact that there are contracts that require professionals to buy insurance that's not available, and there are some negative ramifications because of that, and we as an industry want to correct that. And the way the bill does this essentially is saying that if the insurance is not available, then that type of a clause isn't enforceable. I'd be happy to address any further questions, but that's the sum and substance of it. People have worked really hard for several years to get this in shape, and I think it's we're ready to go now.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Bloomquist. Questions from members of any of the testifiers? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess because I'm not real good with legalese, I'd like to ask a question in kind of a scenario format to help me understand what we're looking at. Let's say a house is being constructed. You've got a contract building official that has possibly his own insurance for liability up to a couple million dollars. And while they're pouring footings, he understands that there's a discrepancy in how that goes down, how the footing is laid in and where it's at. If he doesn't call that out, is he personally liable, or would that coverage, does this indemnify him for not catching that, where the footing is and the house collapses in a
in a number of years, someone's injured. Now, is he identified for missing that, or how does that work in this scenario?
Mr. Bloomquist.
Yep. Thank you. In your scenario, let's assume you have a contractor that's, I think what you're saying is a contractor is placing something in the wrong location. If we have an architect involved or an engineer involved who actually designed something to be placed in a certain location, if it gets placed in the wrong location, if the architect or the engineer was negligent in failing to catch that, then certainly the engineer's insurance will cover it. So it wouldn't affect that type of situation. This bill doesn't absolve anybody of responsibility for their own negligence. All this bill addresses is if you're forced by contract to buy insurance for somebody else's negligence, that's what the bill affects, because that insurance is not available. And the concept in the construction industry is you want to make sure you have insurance for everybody's fault, and we don't want a contract that somehow shifts an insurance obligation to somebody that can't buy it, because otherwise we'll end up with something that's not insured.
If I could respond a little bit, Mr. Chair, to Representative Howe's question. So in your example, if the general contractor had asked the architect to obtain an indemnity insurance agreement that the architect then could not obtain, and the contractor was relying on the architect's insurance to cover that collapse, it's possible if it's a small architecture firm, there's no assets, there's no insurance policy, even though the general contractor was requiring that and the architect signed it because they wanted to do the deal, then there's no coverage. And so I think in your hypothetical, under the bill, if it were to become law, there wouldn't be a potential situation where the architect could have agreed to indemnify the contractor after the law would be enacted. In your hypothetical, the general contractor would know that he was responsible for his own negligence because there wouldn't be a clause in the contract that misled everyone that the architect could insure the contractor when actually the architect can't buy that coverage on the market. I don't know if that clarifies it or makes it foggier.
Representative Howe. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess so what happens when the, let's say that contractor, the building official calls it out and says, you know what, I told you not to pour the footing. You poured the footing anyway. It's in the wrong location. I'm not going to approve it. You can't put in the foundation. And they say, well, I'll go get an engineer to sign off on it. And so they go get an engineer, and is the engineer then still? What's the homeowner's legal recourse if there's no insurance? Does it land, even though the engineer signed it? Who does the homeowner go to then?
Representative Horton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe. So if the engineer signed off on something and the engineer was wrong, it would be the engineer's professional liability coverage. If the engineer or architect weren't consulted and there was no professional negligence and the general contractor had made the mistake by reading the plans wrong or disregarding something a building official said, then the general contractor's insurance policy would cover. So it depends on who's at fault in that case of whose policy would kick in. But the homeowner would, in all likelihood, be covered by the negligence policies that each of the actors on the project would have.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there is insurance available. So I don't understand why you need this then.
Representative Horton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, this is just the professional liability insurance for design professionals. So when you have a job like that, you have so many players, right? That you have the construction industry and you have the design professionals that are involved earlier in the process. And so what this bill deals with is the fact that design professionals can't procure insurance to cover the negligence of the general contractor. They can procure insurance to cover their own negligence, but they can't procure insurance to cover somebody else's negligence. So you wouldn't want to think you were protected and then find out that you actually weren't because that product wasn't commercially available.
Any other questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, then Representative Hortman has moved that House File 2090, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor,
signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Hortman, and the testifiers. Next bill up also is Representative Hortman's House File 2188. The motion from Representative Hortman on this bill will be to refer to the General Register. We have Kevin Dunleavy, attorney. Representative Hortman, did you want to do a brief introduction or just let your testifier take it away?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. The testifier did such a fantastic job in the Judiciary Committee. I think I'll just let him walk through it. Also, I don't have the bill in front of me right now.
Mr. Dunleavy, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. This is our Bar Association Real Property Section bill for the year. The first section of the bill deals with acknowledgments and deeds and mortgages, and the purpose of the amendment is to eliminate gender-specific terms in the acknowledgment of husband and wife. Just as an aside, I did a search on the statutes, and there's 55 references to husbands and 45 to wives in the statute. You can decide if that's because the legislature thinks that husbands need more regulation. I don't know if that's the case, but
depends on the marriage.
It could be. It could be the marriage. So that deals with acknowledgments, and then the second section is excuse me, I'm doing it incorrectly. The first part is designated transfers, and designated transfers are if husband and wife or a single person or a married person owns an entity, and that person or that couple are the sole owners of the entity, a transfer of property between the individuals and the entity is exempt from deed tax. That's considered a designated transfer because there's really no change in beneficial ownership. The person owns the property individually. They put it into an entity that they own 100%. They're really still the owner. And so we just took out the husband and wife language in the designated transfer exemption from deed tax. Section 2 deals with the acknowledgments for deeds and mortgages, and they have to indicate that they're married to each other. If a deed or a mortgage says husband and wife in a notary block, that still works. That's based on custom and practice that husband and wife means married to each other. 507.02 that's a statute that says a husband and wife both have to sign a deed or a mortgage on a homestead or it's void, and we're just taking out the husband and wife and saying married to each other on that also. Okay, section 4 is the transfer on death deeds. Transfer on death deeds it's an estate planning tool that when you die, you can have the property go to your kids and you don't have to go through a probate. That's the most common use. There are some more complicated situations that happen, like, and being from the Red River Valley, I'll talk about bachelor Norwegian farmers. There's three brothers that own the property, and one of them wants to convey it to his kids, and the other two don't. The one that owns the property, the one that is the grantor is the grantor owner. The other two are owners. They're not joining in the deed. And so what we've tried to do is clarify the distinction between what's a grantor owner and what's an owner. Okay, so what do we got now?
Section 5?
Line 311, we're trying to define what's an interest in real property that can be conveyed by a transfer on death deed. It's trying to expand the definition. Subdivision 5. We just took out the reference to specific types of interest because the definition of real property includes those interests now. Subdivision 6. Basically, we're trying to say that if somebody doesn't join, it doesn't eliminate the interest of somebody who doesn't join the deed. I don't think I'm explaining that very well. So if a spouse that's not a grantor, owner, or an owner, if they consent to the deed, then that eliminates their marital interest, either in a divorce or a probate. And we wanted to make sure that that was clear so that these deeds don't go back into divorces and probates. That's the main change in subdivision 6. Subdivision 7, make it clear that all the spouses have to either consent or sign. Subdivision section 8, other interests in real property can be conveyed. That's included in a definition. Section 9, the revocation revokes the deed in its entirety. So if you have more than one grantor on this transfer and death deed, if one person revokes it, it's completely revoked. There's no partial revocation. Okay, section 10. In the last session, we asked the legislature to codify a practice of partial releases, and in the law, the liability section was buried in another subdivision, so we broke it out into a separate subdivision. We didn't really change the substance of the law, but what happened was the title companies noticed that recording a fraudulent satisfaction could trigger liability. I don't think that was something anybody thought about before, and so they've asked us to remove the reference to the person who records a fraudulent satisfaction from having liability, and so that's what the intent of this change is. It's the person that signs a fraudulent release or satisfaction that knows that it's a fraud, and a title company might just be doing it inadvertently. They wouldn't necessarily know. So that's what Section 10 does. Section 11 is a change in a reference to the redemption period in the foreclosure statute. Previously, there was one redemption period in Minnesota, a one-year redemption period. Now there is a one-year, a six-month, 120 days, 60 days, and 5 weeks. And so rather than this redemption statute referring to the old one-year redemption period, it now just says whatever the law is, to period allowed by law. Thank you.
Any questions for the testifier from members of the committee? Seeing none. Oh, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see in section, what is that? Section 4, subdivision 1, where it talks about definitions, where on actually 311, where it starts, talks about property and the interest in real property. And it talks about real property and interest in real property located in this state. So it only deals with property located in the state, doesn't talk about interest in real property located in other states, and this does nothing to affect interest in real property anywhere else as far as how that happens in the transfer of death or anything like that.
Mr. Dunleavy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, that's correct. Minnesota doesn't have jurisdiction over real estate in other states, so if, like, North Dakota has transfer on death deeds, so if a Minnesota resident owned North Dakota property and wanted to do one, they'd have to do it under North Dakota, the North Dakota transfer on death deed statute. It wouldn't, otherwise they're going to have to do a probate in that state.
Any other questions? Seeing none, then Representative Hortman has moved that House File 2188 be sent to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Hortman. Representative Rosenthal, House File 2190. Representative Rosenthal moves House File 2190 be re-referred to the General Register.
You're right.
We may want to wait till the media comes in the room for this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 2190 is an update to the Chapter 302A Minnesota statute known as the Minnesota Business Corporation Act. And today I have John Nygren from Fagery, Baker, and Daniels to walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Nygren. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is John Nygren. I'm an attorney at Fager Baker Daniels, and I'm the legislative coordinator for the business law section of the State Bar Association. The Minnesota Business Corporation Act was last amended in 2010. The bar has a standing committee that typically amends the statute every 2 to 3 years. We're a little bit behind here. The goal of that committee is to ensure that the statute remains up to date and reflective of developing best practices around the country. So that committee does spend a fair amount of time looking at developments in other states and what's going on there. Our ultimate goal is to ensure that Minnesota remains an attractive place for businesses to incorporate and organize. The committee includes representatives from both firms representing more the business side of the aisle, as well as folks representing minority shareholders and others. So it's a broad mix of different attorney groups who debate some of these issues in a fair amount of detail, as well as a representative of the Secretary of State's office to make sure that whatever we do is actually can be implemented by that office. The proposed amendment falls into kind of three broad categories. The first is changes requested by practitioners to keep up with other states. There are provisions providing for cross-border conversion, so converting entities from Minnesota into other states or vice versa from other states into Minnesota. A lot of other states have adopted these conversion provisions that make it facilitate movement among states for various reasons. We also have the bill proposes a process to officially pre-clear Secretary of State filings. This is important when things like merger transactions and other significant events are happening in the life of a corporation, to have the assurance that when the document is filed, it will be accepted and our transaction will be able to close on time. As well as another area here is combined class voting by shareholders. There's another substantive amendment relating to the 2011 Minnesota Supreme Court case in Cold Spring Granite. That case held that dissenters' rights are not available under the Business Corporation Act for shareholders when their holdings are cashed out via reverse stock split and elimination of fractional shares. So I won't get into the details of that case, but the proposed amendment would make dissenters' rights available as a remedy for shareholders in that situation, which we all thought was a fair result. And then finally, there are a number of technical amendments for internal consistency reasons, clarifying ambiguities, and then reflecting changes to other Minnesota statutes. An example there is the interest rate on dissenters' rights claims, where the statutory provision relating to interest rates changed, but we did not make a change to the Business Corporation Act at that time. Finally, there's a few changes conforming the LLC Act to these changes to the Business Corporation Act. With that, I won't go into any details on any specific provisions, but I'm happy to answer any questions any members might have.
Thank you, Mr. Nygren. Questions from members? Seeing none, any other comments you want to make, Representative Rosenthal? I see no. Representative Rosenthal moves that House File 2190 be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Liebling, House File 2545. The motion from Representative Liebling. Okay. Representative Liebling's House File 2545 be re-referred to Judiciary. And Mr. Cody Weiberg is here as well. Representative Liebling, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, as you can see, this is a bill with lots of things in it, and this bill comes from the Board of Pharmacy. And so Dr. Weiberg is here. He's the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy, so I'm going to let him walk through some of the provisions. And just want to thank Representative Holbrook, who just mentioned one little snafu in here that I've mentioned to Dr. Weiberg, and we're going to look into that further and take care of it, Representative Holbrook. So appreciate that, and with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Weiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Weiberg. Please, Dr. Weiberg, I assume you didn't go to all those years of school to be called Mr.
Yep.
Like Dr. Evil. Please proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Dr. Cody Weiberg, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, and this bill does do a whole bunch of things. I believe that the reason it's before civil law, and I, my current could be wrong. I don't actually come before this committee that often, but I believe that there are a couple of areas that the committee would have jurisdiction over. Sections 3 through 7, that's basically a complete rewrite of the disciplinary portions of the Pharmacy Practice Act. This is something that the Attorney General's office has advised us to do now for the past several years. We finally had the time to do it. I think this fits in a little bit with the concept of the uncession, which I think in part at least looks at cleaning up old language. Just as an example of that, the grounds for discipline found in Chapter 151, I did a kind of a little historical search, and they actually date, most of them date from 1941. And we've had no changes to the disciplinary sections of our statutes since for over a decade. On the advice of our Assistant Attorney General, I modeled this language after the disciplinary language of the Board of Medical Practice. There needed to be some modifications because, unlike that board, our board actually licenses businesses in addition to individuals. But I believe the legislative auditor did a review of the Board of Medical Practice disciplinary procedures several years ago and had no major findings. So that was another reason for using that as a model. The other areas of this bill that I believe might be under the jurisdiction of this committee, or perhaps it would be judiciary, have to do with the synthetic or designer drugs. These are drugs that are products, actually, that really are drugs that are sold by head shops, sometimes in truck stops, even convenience stores at some point were selling these. And they're so misrepresented as being things like herbal incense and plant food. Really, they are drugs, and they are either hallucinogens or stimulants, or they act on the same receptors in the brain as cannabis does. The difference being that the synthetic cannabinoids are far, far more dangerous than actual real marijuana is. And this has been a very big issue, the speaker appointed a select committee or special committee just to deal with this issue, headed by Representative Simonson. So you're probably going to see a bill that contains some of the exact same language that's in the pharmacy bill. The Attorney General became interested in this, and she held a hearing up in Duluth, which is sort of one of the epicenters in the state of this problem. She issued a report after that hearing, and I worked with one of her assistant AGs to develop some language in here that does a couple things. First of all, it modifies the definition of a drug to make it crystal clear that these products that are being sold are in fact drugs. And that's key because it is illegal and has long been illegal in this state to sell any drugs that are either misbranded or adulterated. Misbranded simply means they aren't labeled appropriately, and adulterated in this case means they're not produced in an FDA registered and board licensed manufacturing facility. If drugs are misbranded and adulterated, and the board has probable cause to believe that, the board would be able to go into one of these establishments and under this language and issue a cease and desist order, ordering the individual to stop selling the product. Yes, the section number, the cease and desist authority is in section 2. The change in the definition of drug is in section 1. So section 2 really is amending section 151.06 of the statutes, which is the board's power and duty section. So in essence, and this is language that the Attorney General's office took from provisions that the Department of Commerce has. They have similar cease and desist authority, so I'm told that this language actually is modeled after the cease and desist authority that the Department of Commerce has. So in essence, again, the way that we envision this might happen is local law enforcement might go into an establishment, they might seize a sample or take a sample of the product, and if it's determined that this is a drug, the board could then go in and issue a cease and desist order. At that point, the store owner would have the ability to there would be a hearing actually before an administrative law judge, and there would also be, I think, an opportunity to go to court and to show that the board should not have issued the cease and desist order. This would work in combination with power that the board has had for a very long time to issue an embargo. So if we go into any place right now where drugs are stored and we think they're misbranded or adulterated, we can issue paperwork that basically says that this business cannot sell the drug. And then in that case, the board has 60 days to go to district court to have the court order an issue of condemnation. And then that the misbranded or adulterated drug has to be destroyed by that business at its cost. The other section, Section 20, that's related to synthetic designer drugs, adds several more drugs to Schedule 1. This is something that the board has worked with the legislature to do now over the last four or five sessions. Unfortunately, as the legislature adds additional substances to the controlled substance schedules, the individuals who want to sell this product tweak the molecule just a little bit so it's no longer specifically named in the statutes, and then they assert that it's legal to sell the drug again. So it's been described as like trying to play a game of whack-a-mole. You hit one drug down and another one pops up, which is, I think, one of the reasons that the Attorney General came up with this idea of giving the board cease and desist authority and broadening the definition of a drug. So I believe those are the sections that are under the jurisdiction of this committee, I believe.
Dr. Weiberg, I had thought that the BCA had authority to administratively act on those minor tweaks to be included under schedules without legislative action as well. Am I wrong about that?
Mr. Chair, that's incorrect. The BCA does not, and that does bring up a point. The other thing that may or may not be under the jurisdiction of this committee is the Board of Pharmacy is actually the agency that has the authority to engage in the rulemaking process to make changes to the schedules. And a couple sessions back, the board was given expedited rulemaking authority to do that. That expedited rulemaking authority actually was sunsetted this year. And there's a requirement that the board bring it back to the legislature, and if the legislature doesn't ratify the rules, that they expire. And again, the AG's office is recommending that expedited rulemaking authority be extended, and that the requirement to specifically bring it back to the legislature be eliminated, because frankly the legislature could come and make that change at any rate.
Okay, Dr. Weber, yeah. How long is the rulemaking process without the expedited provision?
Mr. Chair, it really depends on the situation. Just as an example, when we first became aware of the synthetic cannabinoids probably 3 or 4 years ago, the board did begin the rulemaking process. And the regular rulemaking process has a provision that says if as few as 25 people ask for a hearing before an administrative law judge, there has to be a hearing before an administrative law judge. We had over 100 requests. The thing about these requests, though, is except for two or three, they were identical. It was actually more of a petition campaign than it was request for rulemaking. The requests were identical down to the misspelling of my last name, and they didn't actually assert any reason. They just requested a ruling. There was no assertion as to why the board should not engage in the rulemaking process. And so that actually would have added, just probably a couple of months. And that's not because of the Office of Administrative Hearings. It's because of the way also that the Board of Pharmacy works. Unlike the cabinet-level agencies, I don't have, even though I'm the chief administrative officer, I don't have the authority myself to make some certain decisions in the rulemaking process. Those can only be made when the board meets in a full public meeting, and they only do that every 6 weeks or so. So there can be some delays on our end as well.
Okay, thank you, Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I had the opportunity to speak with Chair Liebling offline about the data provisions in here, and it has language that states that these reports and et cetera would be investigative data as defined in Chapter 13. There's no definition of investigative data in Chapter 13. Rather, the standard is that you define what data sets will be taken in the course of an investigation, and then you classify them, and they may have different classifications at different periods of time within the process of the investigation. So just for the record, and so that we're clear on what your intent is, I mean, we can get the right language, but I think the committee should have at least some discussion as far as where you want to go with this information. And I'm particularly concerned if you look at the language on page 26, lines 8 through 11, the disciplinary record on judicial review. While you don't have a Chapter 13 classification or reference, I'd also like you to share with us what kind of information will the public never have the opportunity to review.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would let Dr. Weiberg address
Dr. Weiberg.
This.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fulberg, again, this language was modeled on the Medical Practice Act and was actually reviewed by our Assistant Attorney General. But I will go back and talk to our Assistant AG about whether or not that language is truly necessary in our case as opposed to the Board of Medical Practice. On the other issue, I did some, you know, Representative Liebling shared your concerns with me. I did a little bit of searching, and I think what we're intending there is Section 13.41 deals with licensing data, and there is some mention about when data as part of a complaint and disciplinary process is public or private or not, but I will go back and also clarify that with the Assistant AG and make sure I'm not missing anything else. But the way that the boards handle investigative data is that during and we handle it a little bit differently than most boards because we license businesses. And so when we investigate individuals, real human beings, when we investigate any complaint, whether it's a human being or a business, while we're actively investigating it, it's not public data. It's data we cannot release. After an investigation is complete, my understanding from what the Assistant AG has told us is investigative data on an individual remains non-public, although if we discipline the person, the disciplinary order is a public document. But investigative data on businesses becomes public, whether we discipline the business or not. So investigations of a pharmacy, the data would become public after the investigation. Investigation of a pharmacist, it would not become public. But I will verify my understanding with our Assistant AG.
And Mr. Chair, you might want to also review like the welfare data investigation. In their case, if they're investigating somebody for fraud, i.e. taking too much money, that's public through the whole course of the investigation. If you are investigating businesses that may be doing things of harm to the public, there might be some value to that information being public during the course of the investigation. I think you got to kind of think through the different nuances. But I appreciate your comments, but I'd like to, again, go back to this disciplinary record on judicial review. When would a judicial review of any board action, when would that come into play? And is this the review of the actions of the board, or is it a review of the actual decision, you know, affecting an individual? I don't know that I've ever seen that kind of black box around information before, and I'm concerned, and not knowing enough about your process and where this comes into place, I'm concerned that maybe we're missing an opportunity for some sunshine that should be there.
Dr. Weiberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, quite frankly, again, I want to talk to our Assistant AG, but Quite frankly, in our case, the Board of Pharmacy case, we could, if you're uncomfortable with that language, we could probably remove it. My understanding is the Board of Medical Practice actually has a lot of their cases that end up before a court. We don't even typically, our disciplinary cases typically don't even end up before an administrative law judge. It's extremely rare for us to have a contested case. Fortunately for the public, actually, it's a fortunate thing. Most of the discipline that we proceed with involves pharmacists or technicians actually stealing narcotics. And unlike other healthcare settings, most pharmacies have video camera systems. And so actually by the time people get to us, we usually either have them on videotape, actually with evidence, hard evidence that they're stealing drugs, or they sign a confession. And so we almost, I've been here for 8 years, we've not even had a contested case hearing that's had to go fully before an administrative law judge, let alone one that's had to go before a court. So I think we could actually maybe remove that language.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Holbert, I'm comfortable removing that. If Dr. Weiberg doesn't need it, you're questioning it. I don't really know what it's there for either.
Representative Mr. Chair, Holbert,
I would move to strike Section 7 of the bill.
Okay. And that's, can you just restate the lines for
so
that?
So that's 26.8 to 26.11, and that's the provision that Representative Holbert was wondering what the heck it's doing, and I'm not really sure. And this bill does have other stops, and if Dr. Weiberg, you know, consults and feels that some language is necessary, we can always check back with you as well.
Would that meet the parameters you request, Representative Holbert?
Mr. Chair, I think that would be good, as that they're not able to explain to us why they would need that strong a language.
Thank you. Representative Liebling moves to strike Section 7, lines 26.8 to 26.11. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Any other questions, Representative Holbert?
No, Mr. Chair, I'd just be happy to work with Representative Liebling when you bring up the issue about cameras and things. You're probably going to need some language to classify features in a facility that enhance their security. You don't want the public to know where all their cameras and what their anti-theft program is, et cetera. So I'd be happy to work with them.
Does the committee have your commitment to do that, Representative Liebling?
Yeah, absolutely, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I think we're more or less done with the detailed discussion. If I could just kind of make a closing statement.
Well, we have two other questions.
Oh, we do. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I found an example of why it's a good idea to have this provision, any other substance that produces the same effects. On page 49, line 49.4, there appears to be a typo.
Yes.
Yeah, the only ways I can see it spelled that way on the internet are either things that point back to this statute or...
And that's old language. I'm sorry, yes. Mr. Chair. That should be...
Dr. Weiberg.
I'm sorry, that should be... assume you're referring to B-U-T-U-L.
Yes.
That should be B-U-T-Y-L. And I will... see what's currently in statute, but that's actually old language. The legislature added that a couple of years ago.
Well, we could offer an oral amendment to fix it.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Say again, Representative Yaruso.
I'd like to offer an oral amendment to fix that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
I think I could just incorporate that into the bill. Since I'm a member of the committee, I think I can just incorporate it. We don't need to vote on something like that.
No, we need an amendment. Okay, we need an amendment, Representative Liebling. We follow the rules in this committee. Representative Liebling on 49.4 moves to strike the word spelled B-U-T-U-L and replace it with B-U-T-Y-L. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. You earned your keep today, Representative Yaruso. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just this is what an educational day for me, because on page 6, line 6.33, can you tell me what the Minnesota Immunization Information Connection is, where it resides, and how the data is classified once it gets there?
Representative Liebling.
I would, again,
Dr. Weiber,
my testifier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, the Minnesota Information Connection is a program that is run by the Minnesota Department of Health. They are actually the experts here. I don't think they're actually here, unfortunately. I am not 100% sure how that data is classified, but it's been on, that program has been up and running for, I think, at least a half a dozen years, if not longer. And my understanding of it is that individuals, that healthcare professionals that do immunizations, physicians, pharmacists, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, are allowed but not required to report the immunizations they give to that system, and then that system is available to primary care, at least primary care health providers, like family practitioners and pediatricians. It's an electronic system, and they're able to go in and look at the immunization records of the individuals.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on a vet stand down, when they do the veteran stand downs, are when they line up all those veterans and give them flu immunizations, are they're supposed to report all that? This would require them to report all that data to them? Right now, I understand it's a May. Would this require them to do that?
Dr. Weiber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, no, it would not. In fact, this language only applies to pharmacists that do immunizations, and that, it, by and large, the vast majority of pharmacists that do immunizations would probably not be servicing any sort of veterans. The ones that do most likely work for, or may very well work for, the Veterans Administration. Is that not the case? I'm not sure then. But this is only a may. This is not a shall. This is really gives an option to pharmacists who want to report the data to this system, rather than trying to report it to directly to a clinic, which sometimes, quite frankly, is impossible to do, because some of the people that come into a pharmacy to get an immunization don't actually have a regular primary care clinic, and so the pharmacist is left with nobody to report it to.
Representative Howe, any other questions? Any other questions from any other members of the committee? Seeing none, then Representative Liebling had moved that House File 2274 be referred to Judiciary. Now that motion is that it, as amended, House File 2545 as amended be moved to referred to Judiciary. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. There being no other business before the committee, and noting that our next meeting is tomorrow morning at 8:15.
Are we meeting tomorrow night?
We are meeting tomorrow night also, members, just so you know. Committee's adjourned.